Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. I think we can get started. Really, extra thank you, and I always appreciate when everybody comes, and the special appreciation this week that I know we're off kilter on the time, so really I want to thank you very much for coming and inspiring me to give the shiur. Like I mentioned last week, since we're a little bit, we're an hour and a half early, I don't think it's fair to continue exactly where we are in the Seder. So last week we spoke on Alanis Nisim, Chanukah, that worked out very well. This week we'll talk about, we'll see on New Year's Asar B'Tevet, a few, hopefully ideas that you'll find interesting and meaningful. And please God, next week we'll return to our, where we are in Psukei Dezimra and Shvuot Yishtabach and the three songs we say between the end of Tehillim and Yishtabach. So please God, we'll return next week. We'll be on the 9:30 Eastern time schedule. I want to welcome Rabbi Alman, especially, who's a regular, but has been in Israel for a long time. So this is the first week he can attend. I apologize if you won't be able to attend, next week, but a pleasure to see you. Thank you very much. And please God, we'll get together. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. My pleasure. So I just want to start perhaps something a little 5 a.m. in Las Vegas. Well, you get a special bonus. We'll start paying people to come instead of, charging. Okay. Get up at 5 a.m. in Las Vegas. Wow. The gambling must not be so well. Okay. Sorry about that one. Okay. I just want to start with, I think, an idea. I don't know how famous, I don't know how many people are aware of the first Tosfot in Avodah Zarah. Do people know what I'm talking about? The second Tosfot in Masechet Avodah Zarah. Well, one of the tractates of the Talmud is called the Avodah Zarah, idolatry. It's a funny tractate. I mean, it's a funny tractate in the sense that it deals with all idolatrous practices, but it's really the interaction between Jews and idolaters. Obviously, throughout most of, I mean, even in Israel today, however, we've been, most of Jewish history has been lived where the Jews are a minority in the land that they are. Baruch Hashem today, that's not true in Israel, but even in Israel, there's a significant minority of non-Jews. And the question is, what is the relationship? Wine and bread and milk. And the first Mishnah gives a halacha that's a very difficult halacha in many ways. And one that, well, either for, it's not observed in the classical sense. Let's put it that way. And the Mishnah says that the 3 days before an idolatrous festival, you're not allowed to do business with a non-Jew. I think we mentioned this in the past because we're afraid. I mean, it's a very nice idea from the perspective of the non-Jew. He's very thankful to his God for helping him make a lot of money. So he's going to go to his church and say thank you to his sort of, or some pagan place. And he's going to give thanks to it, the deity that they believe in. And we don't want to be the participant in that. So 3 days before, the rabbis put the prohibition. We're not going to go into all the details. So Tosfot, of course, is very bothered, but how come nobody observes that anymore? So I just want to share my screen for half a minute, and I just want to show you the Tosfot. Just give me a second here. Okay. I'll show it to you first. I'll show you in the classical Talmud Bavli so you can see it. This is the, how the classical in the Vilna Shas. So it's this pretty fat Tosfot here. It's pretty skinny for the first, 30 lines down here. And then, over here, another 30 lines, long lines. This is a pretty large Tosfot. Wanting to know, Peusha Kuntris, Mishum de Azil. I don't know if you can see. I can't highlight. Oh, yeah, I can. Biomeito Umodel of Avodah Kachavim. He's going to go on his holiday and he's going to, give thanks to, his idol. And, so the question is, Kasha Masam Kua Olam Lasait. I can't, it's hard for me to highlight this. So if you can see my cursor, can you see the cursor? If anybody can let me know. Somebody? You can, okay. Pekashe amasam kua olam. So how does the world, how does the world, la seifa la tepi yomei? So how does everybody do business? So without getting into all the answers and really discussing it at great length, I just want to point out a couple of things. One of them I find so beautiful, beautiful, scary, and instructive. And he says, how can you do it? And that for sure on at least once a week, every Sunday. Every Sunday, they, even if you don't want to do 3 days in opinion day itself, knew how to do business with non-Jews on Sunday. So in Ontario, you used to have actually blue laws. When I was growing up till, I don't know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, people used to get arrested. I mean, fined, like heavy fines if they opened up their store on Sundays. When my parents grew up in Toronto, you couldn't play baseball. Like you couldn't have any sporting events. Any movie theaters were open on Sunday. That wasn't true when I grew up, but no businesses were allowed to be open on Sunday unless you were in a touristy area. And that was a big, you know, how do you define that? But today, of course, Sunday, everything's open and it's a big day. But that's his question. So I want to discuss the answer he rejects. He doesn't reject because of the reasoning. The reasoning is solid. He's rejecting it for another reason. And that's why I think this reason is so, so powerful. The Ein Lomar, the Hainu Tama, you shouldn't say that they don't worship idols. Why don't they worship idols? They just do what their fathers, you know, tell them. Minhag avotechem biyatam. Meaning, I find this such a powerful comment. Basically, they go to church every week. You know why? Because their parents schlepped them to church. They don't really believe in the stuff. They just go through the motions because that's the tradition that their parents have taught them. Like many Jews, we, you know, Baruch Hashem, I think it's great. Many Jews, I mean, it's great, better than the alternative. They go to shul 3 days a year. What do they believe? All of a sudden, like they get religious on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Jew, they know, you know, that from their grandparents and their parents, you go to shul on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It's a minhag avotechem. You can't say they're not davening, so they don't know what they're saying. Do they know malchiyot, zichron, not shofar? They don't even know what it is. They tell them what time shofar is. It sounds nice. You have to hear the shofar and they go home. They come late, leave early. So minhag avotechem biyatechem. So Tosfot says, that would be reason enough that it's not idolatry, even though they're going to, let's say, even a pagan church and they're praying to all their gods. It doesn't count because they're just doing it. They're just mumbling words that they don't really believe in. So I think I just like to quote that because it's such a powerful lesson for us, because so much of what we do by rote. And it's human nature. It's not easy to do the mitzvot. I always say it's not easy to believe in God. It's easy. I believe in God. Great. But really, belief in God is really hard because if you believe in God, you don't cheat and you don't talk lashon hara. You do all kinds of things when you believe in God. So it's very hard. It's very hard. There's a reason we write Shivita Hashem L'Negdi Tamid in shuls all the time, because it's very hard to really believe that God is there with us. I don't know if I ever quoted that. A friend of mine who lives in Israel. Hopefully we're going to get together after Shabbos, actually. Dr. Benny Gesundheit, he speaks on Torah and Moshe. He's spoken a number of times. He's wonderful. So he gave me a gift when he was in Toronto many years ago. So he gave me the 6 volumes of Dr. Abraham, his medical, I forget now what it's called. Bishmat Abraham. It's basically goes through the Shulchan Aruch. And it's like a copy of the Shulchan Aruch. Anytime the Shulchan Aruch has something that deals with a medical issue, so 90% of it are footnotes on the bottom, you know, explaining what Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said. And it's really an excellent, excellent work. I don't think it's been translated into English, but I could be wrong. So, of course, as we know, the Shulchan Aruch opens with the notion of Shiviti Hashem L'negdi Tamid. God should be before me always. So he quotes on the bottom. I think he quotes the Tshuva Me'ahava. That was Yeshua Fleckless, I believe. I think the last name is Fleckless. He was the successor and student of the Noda Behuda in the 18th century in Prague, as a chief rabbi in Prague. The Noda Behuda is more famous, but this was his top student, Rabbi Yeshua, I think Yeshua, maybe Yehuda, I'm not sure, Fleckless, the Tshuva Me'ahava, I believe. And he quotes there that Shiviti Hashem L'negdi Tamid Neged, what do you mean alongside? God is before me, Negdi, but Negdi doesn't mean, you know, before me, it really means it can be in a long term, it can be against me. Shvita Hashem L'negdi Tamid. So he says you should understand the word neged as an opposition. You should always put God in opposition to you. What does that mean? You should always be concerned that what you're doing is not pleasing to God. That what am I doing? That God is sort of in opposition to what I have to do. It's just very interesting. So doing something by rote, would not count as idolatry. Tosfot rejects that, but not for that reason. So I think if it's true for non-Jews, it's true for Jews too. When we listen, it's still good to do things, even if we're doing them by rote and we're not really paying attention, even if we don't really believe in them when we go because our parents are making us go or whatever, our social pressure is making us go. But that's not really, really worship of God. If you do avoda as minhag avotechem, you're not really worshiping with God. So just very briefly, Tosfot, and so he doesn't like that answer. So maybe Ava, it'll produce all kinds of negative relations. You can't just not do business with the non-Jews. You're living, you know, in the middle of New York City or Toronto or Paris, or Rome. It doesn't work that way. You can't, you're going to say you're closed up. The non-Jews are going to get very upset. So that's, we do allow things that we normally do not allow because of Ava, because of creating unnecessary friction. The most famous case really is to help a non-Jew in times you're not supposed to help them. That's a famous case. The problem of, in theory, you're not allowed to save the life of a non-Jew who's dying on Shabbos. Now you have to realize, in theory, until the time of the Maccabees, you couldn't save the life of a Jew who was dying on Shabbos either. So it's not like, in other words, there was an assumption that Shabbos overrides the life of Jews and the life of non-Jews. In the time of the Maccabees, they introduced the halacha b'chai b'hem, that Jewish law, but they didn't introduce it in regard to non-Jews. They're a little bit less, even though we have to give non-Jews in charity, that's in the Gemara, we have to feed them, and we have to bury them, we have to visit them when they're sick, and have to comfort the mourner. That's what the Gemara says, a pagan, you have to comfort their mourners and visit their sick, but you can't save them on Shabbos, because, you know, Shabbos is so important, maybe even a Jew die. So this halacha, obviously, it's very hard in modern times. It's a halacha that upsets a lot of people. The Ash writes about it. It bothers him. And now, of course, the halacha had a way around this. In practice, nobody says, nobody in practice says to follow this halacha. Based on Eva, you're not allowed to do that. And it'll create tension. Can you imagine in a hospital saying, I'm not going to treat a non-Jew on Shabbos? Oh my God, that would be horrendous. And therefore, it's a terrible thing to do. There's the famous story of Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital. This story I heard that they asked, what if you were on a desert island and there was nobody around there? You know, one of these theoretical, ridiculous questions, and no one would ever know. And it's just you and the non-Jew, and the non-Jew is dying on Shabbos. Would you save his life? No one would ever know. There's no Ava, etc. Of course, that can never be true. So they said what they do. So I heard the story is Rav Lichtenstein said he would save the person's life. He would save the non-Jew's life. And then he'd do tshuva. He did an avera. But, you know, sometimes he can't help himself. His humanism got the better of him. He would save his life and do tshuva. And Rav Amital said he would save his life and not do tshuva. So that's just an interesting approach. But anyways, Ava is an important concept. So Tosfot says maybe that's why we can do business. He rejects that too. Of course, the real, I think, answer that we all follow, and Tosfot alludes to it, although he's before the time, the approach of the Meiri, Rav Menachem of Meiri, I believe, dies in 1406 or 1306. 1406, I believe, now I should know, in Provence, between Spain and France. His works were lost for a long time. That's why until the 19th century, his works were lost. People didn't know about it. We didn't have printing presses and certain books and all kinds of things, the Vatican and all over the place. We really only discovered him recently, but the Meiri wrote an entire commentary on the Talmud. So he famously says, I think this is relatively well known, that the definition of avodah zarah is not based on theology, it's based on morality, that any religion, and he was referring to Christianity of the 14th century, any religion that teaches morality and ethics is not idolatry, and therefore all the Christians today, they're not idolaters, and none of these laws in the Talmud apply to them. That any time that the Talmud makes a distinction between Jew and non-Jew, they don't apply. Whether then there's the whole question, maybe Christianity is not even avodah zarah in the first place. They believe in God. I showed you last week, we discussed the Rambam, you know, the famous Rambam, how famous the censored Rambam that we discussed. Two weeks ago, I think we discussed that the Rambam says Christianity was part of God's plan to bring us closer to the Messianic age. So it's not really idolatry. It's they believe in God, et cetera, et cetera. It's not important. In practice, we all lead our lives that we believe the non-Jews around us are not idolaters. Because if we really did believe they were idolaters, we'd have to limit our interaction with them in many ways. And we know that the Baruch Hashem, many religious non-Jews are wonderful people. I think secularism is a much more of a dangerous thing. Religious extremism is dangerous, of course, but so is secularism. So anyways, I just want to point that out. That's been a long-standing issue for hundreds of years, how Jews do that. The real issue, and this is, we'll sort of switch hats a little bit from the halachist to the historian, Jacob Katz, the great social historian from very, very learned, the professor, the teacher, the Rebbe in history of Chaim Soloveitchik. The Rebbe in Talmud was his father, but the Rebbe in history was Jacob Katz. Chaim Soloveitchik once wrote an article. This stuff, like many of the articles, they're not so easy to understand, though. He's very complex and complicated. He wrote an article once. Mark Shapiro pointed this out. He said he's writing this article for three people. That's the only reason he's writing the article. For his father, for Jacob Katz, and Shaul Lieberman of the seminary. Those are the three people. Everybody else, he's not going to worry about them. But these three people who were on the Gedolei Olam, he was writing the article for. Anyways, the question becomes, and he also, Chaim Soloveitchik talks about this a lot, how does history impact on halacha? In other words, if it wouldn't be for the issues of history, would the halacha have changed? Like, did the historical forces sort of force the rabbis to reinterpret halacha in a certain way that they would not have interpreted halacha that way? It's not that it's deceitful or wrong, chas v'shalom. It means, there are different approaches, the way you can interpret. And because of historical factors, they interpreted a text in a particular way. That's the famous one we discussed. The Chaim Soloveitchik says that when the Jews in Germany in the Crusades committed suicide rather than let the Crusades baptize them, really that there was zero halachic justification for that, especially when they killed their own children. It was terrible, terrible. Said there was absolutely no halachic justification whatsoever for that. But all the poskim in Germany, the Balei HaTosfot, found justification because they had no choice. Well, what are you going to tell a parent? They're so committed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're going to tell them now they are sinners too. It cannot be. So the halakha, that's how he interprets it. He interprets that the historical forces forced the rabbis. There he says it was more conscious. It's a pretty harif the way he describes it. Basically, the rabbis interpreted halacha in a way that they knew was not really the right interpretation. And it's, I don't know, they had to find a way to justify what they did. Anyways, that's an important question. But the most important thing is shalom, to get along with people. Mifnei darchei shalom, mifnei eva. They're two related but slightly different concepts. Darchei shalom, eva. By the way, do people know where the whole discussion of the Mishnah and Darch, I'm sure some people know, but Darchei Shalom and Eva are, there's a whole list of things, including giving the Kohen the first Aliyah, so we won't have any fights in Shul. That's part of Darchei Shalom. There are all kinds of things we do to promote peace. We give the Kohen the first Aliyah is one of them. Anybody know where all those Gemaras appear? I think it's quite instructive. How long should I wait? Okay, Gittin. They appear in Masechet Gittin, which, of course, is, I think, quite instructive that obviously what's the problem in a get, a husband and wife don't have shalom between them. So all the halakhas of how to promote peace are written in Masechet Gittin, and it's in those gemaras that they have the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. All the stories of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash are found in that gemara. Okay, enough of that. Okay, but that's just to point out that at this time of year, especially living in Chutz Laretz, that's what we do. I will point out one fascinating thing just to show you in the Shulchan Aruch how this is the conclusion of a longer discussion, but just let's take a look what the Shulchan Aruch says, the Ramah. The great posek of Ashkenaz Jewry, what just happened here? I don't know what just happened here. Okay, here we go. Yoredeya. So this is in Yoredeya, in Shukharak Simon Kuf Memchet 148. So it's Hilchot Avodah Kochavim. It's the laws of idolatry. How do we do with them? So I'm sorry, it's not showing? Oh, so let me share again. Okay, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened there. Okay, let me do this. You'll let me know if it shows. Thank you, Zev. Okay. Now is it showing?
I see a calendar.
I put away that calendar. My screen sharing is paused. I don't know why that's happened. Resume share. Okay, let's see. I don't know what. So working, not working.
We just see the calendar.
I don't know why. It's not here. I have a thing. Okay. I'm not going to worry about it. What can I do? I won't share. Anyways, I was going to quote you. I'll quote it to you, but you just won't see it inside. The halacha in the Shulchan Aruch 148, Yoredeya, is that if you come in and the non-Jews are having a party, they're having a Christmas party. And they give a Christmas party to your mailman and the postman and the newspaper boy and your people who work for you, your employees. Should give them a Christmas present. So basically, the Rama quotes the Trumet Hadeshem, living in the 15th century from Austria, Rav Yisrael Isserlin, who quotes a lot in the Shulchan Aruch, one of the famous important poskim of Ashkenaz. So the Trumet Hadeshem allows it. He says it's better to give it the day before the holiday. Don't give it on, I think he's talking there on New Year's. If I'm not, it's not in this version of Shulchan Aruch, but I seem to remember it said Nun Yud Yud, like New Year, like Yud Resh. I don't know exactly how they spelled it. So don't give it on New Year's. Give it on, which was really considered the eighth day of Christmas. Now there are 12 days of Christmas. I don't really know why, but there used to be like 8 days between Christmas and New Year's. And he says better to give the gift on December 31st. But if that's what you have to do, you have to give a gift on Christmas or New Year's. You're allowed to give a gift to a non-Jew to promote peaceful relations. We want to get along very well. Okay. I'll just spend a few minutes on some of the customs that developed because of Christianity, Jewish customs that we have today, some of which we've mentioned in various contexts, some of which I don't think we've mentioned. And then I want to talk a little bit the second half on Asarat B'Tevet. Okay, so just to mention some, and most of these come from, I quoted him last week from this wonderful book, Minhagei Yisrael. This is the third volume, Danny Sperber's classic work on the history and development of Minhagim. So he has here a whole book, and it develops geographical influences, like how did snow influence halakha? You know, you live in snowy places and cold, and hagil gorem hageography beituvam shel Minhagim. The geographical idea that changed Minhagim, mikomoshel semo symbols, Kabbalah and Minhagim. So he has a whole thing on how Christian and Islamic influences on halakha. So some of them are well known. I think perhaps the well known, we don't, the minhag in Ashkenaz was you only use white wine on Pesach. We're supposed to use red wine. That's considered more mehudar today. People don't even use wine. They use grape juice, but it was considered, better to use red wine. So why do we use white wine? So that was because of the blood libels. Obviously, if the wine is white, there's no blood in the wine. If the wine is red, so that's a very sad minhag that developed because of Christianity. He has in Chelek Aleph, Dr. Sperber has a whole explanation of a minhag not to fast in Erev Rosh Hashanah. I imagine nobody here fasts in Erev Rosh Hashanah. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, that's the classical reason given why Shlichus begin when there's not 4 days between Motzei Shabbos and Rosh Hashanah. We do Shlichus the week before. The classical reason is so we can fast for 10 days. You have to fast for 10 days during a Aseret Yemei Tshuva to do tshuva. That was very common. People didn't eat as the way we eat. Fasting wasn't the big deal it is for us because we eat so much more. But that was fasting was very common in the Middle Ages. Fast every Monday and Thursday, you know. Shovim Tat, you know, Shmot, Terumah, people. We said fast all the time. Yeshuva, fast. So there was a minhag to fast for 10 days. No, 4 days you can't fast. You can't fast the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. Can't fast on Shabbos. And you can't fast Erev Yom Kippur. So we need to make up the 4 days. So you need a minimum of 4 days to say Shlichus. And then the minhag developed. You can't fast an Erev Yom Kippur. Why can't you fast an Erev Yom Kippur? So he says, I don't know enough about this. I don't know anything about this. He talks about the Ember days. Ember, there was some Christian holiday that occasionally would coincide with the Erev Rosh Hashanah, depending on the year. And they, with the Bedavka fast, that was their religious way of fast, you know, of commemorating the day. And therefore, Jews would dafka eat on Erev Rosh Hashanah. That's, he said, the minhag developed that nobody fasts Erev Rosh Hashanah. No, today, if anybody, I assume the people today who do fast would fast in Erev Rosh Hashanah. But okay. Then we discussed, I think I mentioned recently, not to shake the lulav, like, you know, across, like, you know, there are different minhagim, but obviously people used to shake that way, but it didn't mean anything. It's like, I told you the story I read that when I was in Yeshiva Kotel, I think I mentioned the story that on Purim. This was many moons ago, 40 years ago. And I mean, Yeshiva Hakotel, there's no internet. You spoke home on the phone once a month. People didn't know anything. They had, you know, Christmas lights in Meir Shalom because that's what they bought for cheap. They don't know what they are. So we started to sing on Purim. I told you that. And the Rav Hadari, the Rosh Yeshiva came. He was so excited. The people from Chutzlart were getting into the singing. He had no idea. I mean, we were rolling on the floor like, you know, 18-year-old kids. You don't know what it is. You don't know what it is. And so in certain places, people don't think of anything. In any place, I'll just say I was here on the last day of Hanukkah. I went. It was very beautiful. I went to Shir Chadash, and they had a musical hallel. They had a guitarist, a saxophone, and what was the third person? I forget now. Playing one of also like, you know, the mouth instruments, and it was a very beautiful hallel. I don't know. Somehow, if you pulled that off in New York, you'd be accused of being a reform shul, I think. I don't know. Anybody go to shul where they do a musical? Here, it's very common. Chol HaMoed, Hanukkah, they do it all the time in many places because they don't have the issues of reform with the organ on Shabbos and the this and that. So it's okay. They just play musical instruments. It's very beautiful. The Beit HaMikdash, they play music. But in Chutz Laaretz, because of the influence of reform, became prohibited to play music in davening. Please, if anybody goes to shul where they ever play music, I would love to hear that. But I'm not aware of anybody. Oh, Link, I just seen now this last comment. Evan, music, Lincoln Square, new Lincoln Square. Okay, no, that's great, but that's interesting. Yes, Yocheved, I see you have your hand up.
Hey, I just want to share, not exactly about the musical hollow, but I was telling my husband how nervous when I go to the malls this month, how the constant stream of the Christmas songs they stick in my head. So he just pointed it out. I just want, he has a real sense of humor. He said 90% of them were written by Jews.
Yeah,
so that
course.
Makes me feel a little better.
They are written by Jews, anyway. Of course. All the Christmas, right. Many of the Christmas carols. But the truth of the matter, I remember Rep Tabori telling us in high school, it's really true that, really true. The Gemara in Ksuvos, where it talks about the love of Eretz Yisrael, the love of one's wife, Ksuvah, the love of Eretz Yisrael. Like, you know, the Agadas and Lachas always mixed. So the Gemara there says, whoever lives in Chutz Laaretz, maybe I can say that because I'm visiting Israel, but I include myself in this, of course. Whoever lives in Chutz Laaretz is Ovdei Avodah Zarah B'Tahara. They're worshiping idols in purity. They're not mamish worshiping idols, but they're, you know, worshiping idols. In other words, we're very, you know, Santa Claus and I'll be honest, it's nice, you know, it's nice. You go and the musical spearmint is nice. People are nicer this time of year. There's a certain, you know, and everybody knows jingle bells and things. So this is like idolatry, Avodah Zarah B'Tahara. You live in Chutz Laaretz, you can't help it. You're totally influenced by our culture. There's never been a stronger culture than American culture. I mean, I don't think that the Jews have, even in Spain, we were never integrated the way we are today in America. So much of that is very wonderful. But we're Ovedei Avodah Zarah B'Tahara. I mean, it's sort of, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to make of it. But so that's, yes, we know everybody knows all the Christmas songs and everybody knows because that's why we grow up. Okay, we should make something good. Even though, you know, one, I'm not into rock music at all. But, one of the reasons to criticize, God forbid, it works. They bring people closer. But a lot of the Jewish music guys, what do? They take rock music and they just, you know, play it. I was walking. And they turn it into Jewish sounding stuff, but it's really it's very Goyish music. They just put nice Jewish words or something, or the tzitzis are flying out to make it Jewish. I was walking in Mamila, on Thursday. And then, the Rockaway in Mamila, and there's a guy playing the violin very nicely. He's playing Simon and Garfunkel. I mean, I reckon that, I'm going to Strawberry Fair. What's it called? Right. I was not into Simon and Garfunkel, but how can I not know that? So he's with a Bekesha and a long beard and a big black kippah. And that's what he's playing on the violin. I just walk over to him in English. I could have said, I said, how long have you been a Baal Tshuva for? Because obviously, you know, a guy who grew up in Israel, I mean, that he's not playing Simon and Garfunkel, but he grew up in the States. You know, he can wear a Bekish, like a long black coat and, the payas and the beard and the black kippah and playing Simon and Garfunkel. I thought it was so, I don't know, beautiful, I guess. I gave him a few shekels, you know, that's how they make money, you know, same place. So anyways, okay, back here. So yes, we're very influenced, but these were minhagim that developed that we shouldn't be too influenced. We shouldn't fast and we have to, you know, okay, that was to protect. Al pi Hashem biyad Moshe, we spoke about that just a few weeks ago. Vizor HaTorah shir, so Moshe, Al pi Hashem biyad Moshe is added on later. It's a different pasuk, has no connection. It's a half a pasuk, you're not allowed to say. Because the Christian said, the Torah, we have a new Torah. We say, no, our Torah is Al-Pi Hashem, B'yad Moshe. And of course, you have the minhag that, you know, Mark Shapiro's a long class, not to learn on Nitalnach, not to learn on Christmas. And then you have people who are machmer all year. They don't learn all year, lest, God forbid, they may come by mistake and learn on Christmas Eve. But, so that minhag that, again, is no application in Israel and many places, even for us. And it's really a Hasidic minhag today, and the Hasidim still observe it. I teach with someone in chat I knew for sure, because I have my students who said, I said, go ask the rabbi. He learns on Christmas Eve. So they went to ask when they came back. He said, yeah, I learned, but I'm sure I don't learn. He says, and he's a Lubavitcher, you know, he says, I don't learn, but I bet you Rabbi Kelman does learn on Christmas Eve. That's what he told the kids. So tell me, which of course that's obvious. So anyways, okay. And then just, by the way, there is the minhag, again, I don't want to get into the whole issue, but Danny Sperber quotes it, that the earliest sources in the Middle Ages for the lack of a need for a woman to cover her hair. This was already said in the Middle Ages by Rabbanim in Ashkenaz. He said it's a Christian woman. So here it's interesting. Sometimes we do a minhag because the Christians do A, we do B. And sometimes because what's the norm is the Christians, that becomes the norm among us. Like, so he says, for example, to wear shoes. They forbade walking bare feet in the street on Tisha B'Av. They didn't have shoes like us, you know, shoes that aren't shoes that we wear. They didn't wear shoes. No, to walk on the street, the goyim would make fun of us. So the Ashkenazi poskim said, you have to wear shoes to shul on Tisha B'Av. When you get out to shul, you'll take off your shoes. So the same thing, they have an idea that they quote already, minhagim, and this is, you know, whatever, without getting the whole issue, this is the heter many people say, you know, how is it that so many observant women don't cover their hair, that it's not a form of modesty anymore. I mean, I just see they sentence in Iran this woman to 10 years in prison because she took off, and that's a you know, not to be married in Iran, of course, the whole riots going on. She took off her hair covering. They put her 10 years in jail. Oh my gosh. So, but they say since the non-Jews, the Christians don't cover their hair, it's not immodest. And that's really the heter. This is not a modern heter in the 20th century, a modern orthodoxy. This was a heter. I'm not saying, and we know that there are many, many great women, the wives of many, many great women rabbis. I don't have to start mentioning names. Those who know, did not cover their hair until most of them started to cover them in America. But in Europe, they didn't cover their hair. And for generations, Rosh Yeshiva's wives did not cover their hair. And that's part of what it's based on. The Christian song, if the Christian woman, if you live in Iraq and you live in Libya, then you got to cover your hair, but not if you live in France or Germany. That's not the minhag. So you have very often, even important halachas, even like real halachas, are greatly influenced by the surroundings. I'll just mention too, we had our tour with Shuli Mishkan the last couple of days. So on the Wednesday, we're in the Old City. So we're on Karaite. We went to the Karaite Shul outside. And of course, remember Daniel Lasker gave a 3 wonderful part series on Karaite Judaism. So, there are, I'll just mention 2 halachas that I don't know if who all observes them, but you know, the Balamor mentioned that a person who doesn't eat chulant on Shabbos, we suspect he's a heretic because the Karaites wouldn't eat chulant on Shabbos because lo tavar esh b'chol moshvotechem. You're not allowed to light fire. They didn't believe you could heat it up in advance. That wasn't in the Karaite oral tradition. So in order to show you're not a Karaite, you better eat chulant. Otherwise, we suspect you're a Karen, and I've mentioned a number of times. That's the origin of the Ashkenazic minhag to say Bamem Adlikin on Friday nights. Why do we say Bamem Adlikin? What we can light the oil with, why not? So the minhag developed in response to Karaism. The Karaites said you can't light fire at all. The Rabbanit said, of course you can light fire. We just have a question. What fires can you use? You better make sure to use a clear oil that you're not going to fidget with it, that the light is clear on Shabbos. And that's, of course, the basis of our Hanukkah discussion. It's on that Mishnah, which is okay. On Shabbos, we're afraid you'll fiddle with it. On Hanukkah, we're not really afraid you'll fiddle with it because you're not allowed to use the Hanukkah light. So that's the whole discussion. But those are Karaite, those are anti-Karaite traditions. Okay, enough of that. Let's move on. Just let me see if there are any quick questions here, and then I'll move on to Asarah B'Teveit, 5 a.m. in Las Vegas. Okay. Bergen County still has blue laws. Correct. In New Jersey, right on Route 4, all the shopping malls are closed. That's right. New York used to have blue laws. Yeah, of course. Rabbi Chwersky once told me one of the biggest challenges for an FFV person with davening is not to be right. 100%. Yes, we daven. I sometimes even tell my kids, sometimes non-Orthodox people have an advantage. They go to shul when they want to go to shul. We go to shul because we have to go to shul. Now, hopefully we also want to go to shul, but not always. We daven because we have to daven. You know, I don't have to tell you, if you think putting on tefillin every day, I'm thinking once in a while. Hopefully, because I do it every day, at least I'll be inspired on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, maybe the odd time here, maybe a musical challah will inspire me. But when you only go to shul, when you want to every month, then it's easier to be inspiring. That's 100%. It's really, it's hard. We have a bigger challenge. And one line prayer each time you daven, 100%. That's why I'm giving this whole class on the Siddur. This today is really a little bit different. This has been great for me. I thank you for allowing me to give the shiur. So I'm learning more about the davening. It is enhancing how I daven, without a doubt. These shiurim enhance how I daven. If it enhances your davening, that's even wonderful, more wonderful. For those of us Baalei Tshuvos who struggle with meaning and intention fluidity, must work to comprehend and not rely on inspiration. Okay, that's interesting. When you're working, I think Baalei Tshuva, I think a lot of them both are inspired. That's why they become Baalei Tshuva. I don't know. I'd like to, you can clarify that maybe a little later. I don't have time today, but that's a very interesting comment. My non-friends and a very learned guru I met from India told me their statues provide inspiration to the source we call the one God. Yeah. So that's a question they had with the Indian Shaitos. I'm not getting into Eastern religion. That's not our discussion. But the Meiri's point is any religion that has a moral base, you have to realize with the pagan world, the way they treated people. Unfortunately, the way today, the issue with the Meiri is it could turn some of Islam, it could turn Iran into a Avodah Zarah. In other words, Islam was always assumed not to be idolatry because they believe they can't stand. They considered the Christians idolatry, of course. When they drew in France the cartoon there, they went and they killed them, So the Muslims are very, very strict on images of God, etc. So the Muslims, the Rambam says very clearly, Muslims are not of the Avodah Zarah. But if you take the Meiri's definition that Avodah Zarah is not, what's it based on? It's based on if you believe in God, you're a moral person. It's a very simple idea. That the idea of God is to promote ethics and morality. That's what we believe. That's why God gave us a Torah, to be good people. So any religion that has laws to be good, that's what it means. Believe in God. I don't care that they believe God as children. It doesn't matter. It's not, it may be idolatry for a Jew, but not for a non-Jew. But if their religion teaches to kill people and to terrible things, what kind of a God do they believe in? That's an idolatrous God. And therefore, it's not the theology. But if you take the Meiri to its point, then you may have religions, Islam, or the extreme elements of Islam may have definitions of Avodah Zarah. I remember I always thought that. I never saw anybody else who said it until Rabbi Riskin once wrote this in print. So I was happy that at least, I wasn't the only one who thought like this. Yes, it frees Christianity from being idolatry, but it may create more idolaters. All right. Not paskening who's anyways, but yeah, these are difficult issues. The idea is to promote peace. That's why the Torah was given. I wrote on my Hanukkah piece last week. If you saw the Rambam men's Hilchot, Zmanim Hilchot, Hanukkah, it's an unbelievable statement of the Rambam. The entire Torah was given to promote peace, period. That's why we have a Torah. Derachecha derachei Noam, that's how the Rambam ends Hilchot Zmanim. Hilchot Hanukkah, Hilchot Zmanim, that's how the Rambam ends. The Torah was given to promote peace, period. End of discussion. That's the Torah. Unbelievable. Okay, how to interact with idolaters? Nicely, be friends with them. Be friends. Everybody's created in God's image. I told you the Gemara says, and the Gemara does assume they are idolaters, pagans, it's before Christianity or whenever. The Gemara does say a person who's an idol worshiper, mitnei darchei shalom, to promote peace, you give him charity, you visit the sick, you bury the dead, you comfort the mourners. That's a Gemara in Gittin. That's what I said, Gittin 60b, if you want to look it up. If you don't believe me, you don't believe me, but it's always, maybe you don't believe me, but it's good to look it up always and to see for yourself. The Gemara is very clear. We make a sharp distinction between our religious interaction with them and our social interaction. We don't drink wine with them. We don't socialize. But when it comes to businesslike and friendliness and being a decent human being, there's no distinction between an idolater and a Jew. We have to treat the idolaters with respect, and they all are created in the image of God. Okay, many cultures have festivals or theaters. Yes, okay, yeah, correct. Okay, Lincoln Square musical. Hello, meaning good, right? I want to get to Sarah but David. Absolutely. That's the whole question. Listen, Ma Osur is a German bar song. So many of our tunes. Listen, you go to shuls, you think in 100 years people are going to know. When they go to shuls, they sing Adon Olam to 100 different tunes. And of course, they're borrowed. As a matter of fact, I think I mentioned Rabbi Gemara, who has spoken occasionally here, gave a whole shiur once. How it's well known. This is well known in Italy. Some of the rabbis were heavily critical of this, but it happened. In Italy, the chazanim would go to church, would sit in the back of the church to pick up tunes and then bring them to the shuls because they have beautiful tunes. So the rabbis didn't like that so much. But lemaisa, church tunes were brought into the shuls. Of course, we're greatly influenced. Our music is totally influenced by it. Okay, musical slichas. Okay, great. So I'm okay. Happening in Chutzlarts too. Very good. Kingsway had a musical slichas. So I guess I don't know what I'm talking about. My shul has not had a musical anything. So maybe, Zev, we have to talk about bringing to church. I think the Beit maybe did have a musical slichas, actually, now that I think of it. But okay. With Fast and Air for Shoshana, Rabbi Zulman Karlov. Very interesting. Okay. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, he's not worried about this. The musical slichas, I'm thrilled to see everybody throwing me in where they're saying musical slichas everywhere. Yes, we borrow from our cultures. Okay, let's talk in a few minutes, and I really can't go late today. Lech Munching in Yerushalayim is at 4:09 and shul is at 4:25, so I apologize. I have to end on time. Okay, but let's talk about a few minutes on Asar B'Tevet. So let's start. I'm going to try my share screen once more. If it doesn't work, it won't work. What can I do? But let me share my screen here. Okay. Okay. Do people see?
Working.
Oh, Baruch Hashem. Okay. Let's make sure I got the right one. Okay. Here we go. Now I can't see it because, okay. Okay. This is the slichas that we say on Asara B'Tevet. On Tuesday. Eskara Matsoka Sherkarani, I remember the trials and tribulation that caused me. Bashalosh Makot Bachodise Hikani. With three things I was hit. Three terrible things happened in this month. Gidani Hidiani Hikani Akatal and all the terrible things. We start. You notice the beauty. Okay, we're not going into the whole peel, but the P team are beautiful. You notice an alphabetical acrostic, Aleph Bet Gimel Dalet Hei Vav, right? And then you have this sort of the Zayin Chet Tet Yud Kaf Lamed, right? Alphabet, right? You have this thing a middle, and of course it rhymes. Karani, Hikani, Helani, Yemani, Taanit, Yevanit, the Greeks, Manit, Geper, Tsefer. Beautiful piyutim here that we say. So on the 8th, Bishmona Bos Malit V'Yemanit, I was pushed on the right and the left from all over. Halo Shloshtam Kavati Tanit. I made a fast for 3 days. The king of Greece forced me to write in the Greek religion. Because of this, we have the terrible long travails, terrible suffering. Now, what's this? And then what have? Okay, so that's, so we know. Okay, why don't I show you this Gemara? The Gemara in Megillah, well-known Gemara. They tell me Hamelach. Time of the Greeks. Took 72 rabbis. Interesting. Why 72 and not 71 as a Sanhedrin? But we'll leave that. The Gemara in AD, it does seem to imply that there was a Sanhedrin of 72 people. If you look in the first, Mishnayos in AD up there, I believe that's where we're talking about 72 people. 72 houses. He didn't tell them why. And he told each one of them, Kituli Torah Moshe Rabchem. And translate the Torah. And a miracle happened, and they translated it all the same, but they had to change things. Instead of writing they wrote Elohim Bara Bereshit. Because if you write Bereshit Bara Elohim, it sounds like Bereshit was the one who created God. And if you write Es Adam, right now, Es Adam, how do we say, we will make man? It's we will make man. So they go through all the occasions, but the Gemara says they had a 3-day fast, a 3-day fast for a translation of the Torah. So that's pretty wild. So this is just an, write that on the 8th of Tevet, darkness descended on the world because the Torah was translated. So this is, just to point out, it's a fascinating Gemara. So it's, you know, are translations good or bad? So when I believe it was Rav Menashe Klein in Bor Park, who wrote Harif Attack. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. I'm pretty sure it's him. I'm sorry. I don't have all my swarm here. Look it up. A very Harif on Art Scroll. He was very upset when Art Scroll translated the Gemara into English. And, cause you cannot know, everybody knows there's no such thing as a translation. Every translation is a commentary. And, you got to learn the Gemara in Aramaic. You got to break your head. You know, now you can just read the Gemara. You don't even have to work at it. You just read the Art Scroll notes at the bottom or Stein says, whatever you read. There has always been tremendous opposition, or I know opposition, but there, the Gemara here says they fasted for 3 days because they translated the Torah into Greek. So I just want to raise the issue. On the other hand, let me show you one other source, it's actually a pasuk in Chumash. So it's a Rashi in Chumash. Let's see. Do I have it here? I hope it's still working. Here we go. Be'ever Yerdain, this is the opening of Sefer Dvarim, the first 5 verses in Sefer Dvarim. So, Be'ever Yerdain, Be'eretz Moel, Hoi Moshe, Be'eret HaTorah Zot. And the Be'ever Yerdain, Moshe began to explain the Torah. Be'er HaTev, he explained it really well. Be'er Moshe HaTorah, here it doesn't say. Be'er HaTorah HaZot, Le'mor. He explained the Torah. What does it mean to explain the Torah? How do you explain the Torah? B'shivim Lashon. He explained Torah in 70 languages. That's the, you know, there's 70 nations of the world, 70 languages. He wrote Torah in English and French and Portuguese and Spanish. You have to, people don't know Hebrew. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was opposed to yeshivas in America teaching Bivrit, because if they teach Bivrit, they're not going to understand what's going on. And, on the other hand, you can't really learn Torah if you're, I mean, maybe today you can, I don't know, if you don't know Hebrew, but you can't learn real Torah, true Torah without knowing Hebrew. That's a old debate, but you just be aware that there was a fast day created apparently on the 8th of Tevet, 3 days because of Torah, darkness descended into the world because Torah was translated, and Torah can never be translated. And that's the tension we have. I personally believe that, I do actually believe that certain works should not be translated. I the Mishnah Berurah being translated into English, I think is my opinion. No one has to agree with me. If you don't know how to read the Mishnah Berurah in English, you shouldn't be reading the Mishnah Berurah. You don't have to learn the Mishnah Berurah. It's not the end of the world. You have the Ark. There are many other books to learn. It's not, Mishnah Berurah is not the type of book that is meant for someone. It's written. That's what all the Gedolim said. Rav Henkin said, Rav Kanetsky said, the Mishnah is Torah is for Talmidei Chachamim B'nai Yeshiva, and the Aruch HaShulchan is for average people. So they're certain. They translate everything into English. I don't know if the Gemara has to be translated into English either. It is, and maybe it's wonderful, and Daf Yomi would not be Daf Yomi without Art Scroll. I mean, Koran's a little late to the game, but they're, you know, they're also now in the game. But without Art Scroll, the Daf Yomi would be a tenth of the size that it is in America, for sure. So in many ways, there's millions of hours are being learned because of Torah in translation. But it does have a downside, and maybe people should, and whether Rav Avadya Yosef said, people who have an hour a day to learn should not be learning Gemara. The Gemara is also not meant for everybody. Gemara was never studied historically. I don't know what the answer. I'm just throwing out a few ideas. You can think about it and tell me how wrong I am and how much you might disagree with me or agree with me. But I do think it's important to be aware that there is a strand in our tradition to be very wary of translations, even of the Torah. Now, we do know, of course, Unkelus, and we do know for many years, they read the Torah in public in Hebrew and in Aramaic. So again, it's not either or, and it's both, and the translation, but Unkelus was sort of a, you know, he got approval, like, and, you know, you have to know what the translation is. So anyways, I just want to, that's the fast. Now, then there's the fast of the 9th of Tevet, right? Anybody here fast on the 9th of Tevet? Probably nobody fasts on the 9th of Tevet. Good. Okay, so let's see why we fast on the 9th of Tevet. Does anybody know why there is a fast day on the 9th of Tevet? So let's look over here. Orach Chaim, is this it? Everybody sees this? It's working? Yes? Okay. Yamim Shemitanim Bo. Tuf Kuf Pei. 580 in the Shulchan Aruch. Days we fast. 3 Sifim. This is unbelievable. So Siman in the Shulchan Aruch, nobody follows. The Beit Yosef writes, nobody follows this, but he does quote it in the Shulchan. Beit Yosef is the Shulchan Aruch, just in his commentary on the tour. He quotes nobody fast these days anymore, but in the Shulchan Aruch, he quotes them. These are the days that bad things happen, and we fast up, and even though some of them are on Rosh Chodesh, you're not allowed to fast on Rosh Chodesh, Yesh mi shomer sheitan, but you still fast. Some say you shouldn't finish the fast if it's on Rosh Chodesh and 5 minutes early. Okay. You should fast on the first of Nisan. Wow. The children of Aaron fasted. On the 10th of Nisan, we're fasting because Miriam died on the bear. On the 25th of Nisan, 26th, Yoshua died. You have to fast. On the 10th of Iyar, Elia Cohen died. You fast. Okay. On Kavchet, Kavkan Besivan, the Bikurim ended. Yemei Yeravam on the 25th. All these halach times you fast. I just like to, if you on the 1st of Av, Aaron died. That's the only Yortzeit mentioned in the entire Chumash. The only person in the Chumash whose day of death were given is Aaron. It says he died on the first day of the 5th month. And of course, I think that's not a coincidence. That's sort of foreshadowing what Av would be like. Aaron is a man of peace. Av is the month of Sinat Chinam, unfortunately. So Aaron dies on the 1st of Av, accustomed to fast. And then on the 5th of Tishrei, we fast, and we fast all these days. And then, here we go. Okay. Bekavchet Bekislev. Wow, the middle of Hanukkah. It says in the Shulchan Aruch, you're not allowed to fast on Hanukkah. Shulchan Aruch himself writes, you're not allowed to fast on Hanukkah. This is like, he writes this anyways. He puts it in on the 28th of Kislev. There was a custom to fast because Jehoiakim burnt the Megillah that they got from Yirmiyahu. Sheketat Baruch. Okay, Yirmiyahu. Okay, good. Shmona B'Tevet, that's what I'm talking about. The 8th of Tevet, we fast. Because the Torah was written in Greece, Nitnava Torah Yevani, Bimei Talmei Hamelech. That's the story I just showed you in my second Megillah. Vayachoshech Ba'olam, darkness descended to the world for 3 days. Wow. So this is the very anti-translation idea. Betetbo lo noda eziat sarashi repo. We don't know why we fast. We have a tradition to fast on the night of David, right? Everybody fasts on the night of David. I don't know why. We fast. That's what we do. Okay, so let's take a little look. Let's take a look what our Slichas has to say. So let's go back to our Slichas. So our Slichas says, Za'amti b'tisha b'chlima b'chefer chashach me'elai me'il hod v'tsefer, beautiful Hebrew. There, I lost my beautiful coats and I have embarrassment. Taraf, taraf, I was ripped up. Hanotenim re'shefer, the one who gave the words of God, Ezra was a second Moshe Rabbeinu, who Ezra HaSofer. So Ezra HaSofer died. He on the 9th of Av, the 9th of Tevet. That's what the author of the Slicha says. There is a tradition that Ezra died on the 9th of Tevet, and therefore we are going to fast on the 9th of Tevet. Very nice. Okay, and why? And that Yom Asiri, that's Taka, we do fast. Yom Asiri, Tziva Ben Buzi, that is, of course, Yecheskel, who prophesied for the first temple, destruction of the first temple. K'tav la'acha b'sefer machazeh, write down. You should know this nation that's doing all these terrible things. La'am na'meis b'nivzeh, belittled nation. At etzem hayom hazeh, right? That says we fast at etzem. Asar b'tevet, if it ever fell on Shabbos, which it never does, that's what they say based on the word etzem, on the essence of that day, like on Yom Kippur. The etzem of Yom Kippur, we would fast even on Shabbos. Of course, that's the day of the siege. The Babylonians put the siege on Yerushalayim. So that's what he claims, that on the 9th of Tevet, Ezra died. It's interesting why we don't have a fast when Moshe Rabbeinu died. So if anybody's interested, I have here Schneer Lyman's amazing article. Everything he writes is amazing. Schneer Lyman's article, The Scroll of Fast, the 9th of Tevet. And he has a whole discussion here. Why do we fast on the 9th of Tevet? And he basically says we have no idea. He follows the Shulchan Aruch. He gives about 6 different reasons, including Ezra. And he shows why each one cannot really be correct. And like everything he writes, very scholarly, very, learned. And, why? So I'll just go through some of the reason. See, none is more, of all the enigmas surrounding our text, this Megillat Tanit, none is more enigmatic than its formulation, the fast record on the ninth of Tevet. That's in its earliest formulation reads, B'tisha bo lo katvu rabbeinu amahu. On the ninth, the rabbis didn't write. It's not the same thing as saying they didn't know. Now we don't know. The original rabbis obviously knew why they were fasting, but we don't know why. So, okay, then he goes through all the manuscripts and what they say. Very nice. And the first one is Sefer HaKabbalah. So Shmuel HaNagid. Shmuel HaNagid was like the Abar Barnel five times over, you know. He was a military person, the leader of the Jewish people, a Torah scholar, a financier, everything in the 10th century, I believe. So he was killed on the 9th of the Tevet, and that's of course why they say we don't let you know when the fast is, because the fast began before like Shmuel HaNagid, and that would be, it was foreshadowing his death. So you don't want to, like, it's, you know, the old joke, why doesn't Yosef read like Parshat Vayeshev, like doesn't even remember from last year what's going to happen, right? So in other words, he can't say what's going to be in the future, but he presents that was one reason. Another reason that was given is Esther was taken in Bechodesh Hasiri, Batilakach Esther Beit HaMachut. Of course, why should we fast? Because Esther was taken in. There's no reason. There's no reason to fast for Shmuel HaNagid. We fast. What about five? What about for Rabbi Akiva? We don't fast for Rabbi Akiva. Even the Minhagim Asfirat HaOmer are not mentioned in the Talmud. They're post Talmudic, right? The fact that we mourn a little bit for the death of the students of Rabbi Akiva, that, I don't believe that's in the Gemara at all. Right. So it's very interesting, like why that would be. Ezra died. That's one explanation that the author of the Slichus is telling us. And then you have in the 19th century, you move into the Christian explanation. Jesus was born the 25th of December in the year zero, whenever he was born, the ninth of Tevet. The problem, of course, with that is there's zero evidence, maybe less than zero. Maybe there is negative evidence that just isn't true. But the most interesting reason, the one that's...
Rabbi Kalman, Nittel, some people say, is an abbreviation for that. No, Lad Yeshu Tetlatev.
Yeah, lots of people have said that. That's the Christian tradition. He was born and his bris was on the 1st of January, of course, 8 days later, right? So, yeah, but we know it's not really historically true. I didn't go through the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. There was always a holiday this time of year, Festival of Light. I think somebody was commenting in the notes there. Yeah, whatever that is, but that doesn't seem to be historically accurate. Now, the true matter, we do have minhagim that we observe that are not historically accurate. I mean, that's, we know things Danish Berber discusses. Yeah. I mean, mistakes crept into the system and, they were observed. And then even I'll tell you the most extreme example. The most extreme example is the fraudster who wrote the book, the Psamim Rush, written by Levine. His father was one of the great Gedolim in Vilna, I believe, and the son was he was a serious Talmud Chacham, and he wrote the Psamim Rush. He claimed to have found the manuscript of the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, one of the great Rishonim, and he published it with his notes, and he snuck in. He was a reformist. He was and he wanted to reform certain areas of Halakha, the 1800s. And so he snuck in all kinds of wild tshuvot that he claimed were by the Rosh. But the most of the book is totally normal, legitimate. That's how you have to do it. If you make a book just of crazy tshuvot, no one will accept it. So he did a really good job. And he snuck in a few, you know, wild things. You don't need mikveh anymore. I know all kinds of what, or the Shiva Nakim, I think he got rid of. He got rid of a few things like that he put in there. And he published it. Rosh, he got haskamas from great rabbis. Wow, he discovered it, and he was a Talmud Chacham. And then slowly but surely, people started noticing, and we now know today it's a total fraud. We know that he made up the whole book. You have to be pretty smart. Got to be pretty big Talmud Chacham to do something. So Rav Avadya Yosef has a tshuva. We still accept a tshuva in the Psamim Rosh. It's unbelievable. We can still not always, even though we know it's a fraud, for a number of years, it was accepted as part of the canon. And when it gets accepted as part of the canon, it therefore is a source that we can rely on. because maybe his reasoning is good. Other people say, look at the tshuva if it makes sense. So it wasn't the Rosh, but that's an amazing idea. That, in other words, they don't throw up the whole sefer. So that's, I think, the most extreme example we have here. But anyway, we have all kinds of, interesting other examples where minhagim develop, and they're based, I'm not talking about minhagim that once made sense, that the reason doesn't apply and we keep them, which the halakha doesn't require you to do anymore. We need a whole other shiur for this, not now. Minhagim that were mistaken from the beginning, but it got in. Okay, the last thing, because it is getting late, that Dr. Lyman gives the most credence to, but at the end demonstrates that it can't be true, is that this person, and there are two versions of his name, different manuscripts, Shimon Hakopas or Shimon Hakapolni. I think he was a Jewish great sage in the early days of Christianity who infiltrated the church, became like a spy, and he became the bishop of Rome. And the goal of his infiltration of the church was to turn the church away from Judaism, because we all know, v'lo mashim, the early Christians considered themselves the heirs of Judaism. They came to shul. You didn't know. That's what you didn't know. If the chazan stopped the mashim, you better get a new chazan. You didn't know who was the good chazan, who was the bad chazan. You didn't know. They were all the same. You couldn't distinguish between those who believed in the false messiah or whatever, and this and that. So in order to sort of make sure we don't have the problem, he infiltrated the church. That's the, in Toldot Yeshu, this is we have sort of a tradition, and that he turned Christian. We're going to make Shabbos on Sunday and all kinds of things. We're not going to observe Jewish law. So now we know who's Jewish, who's Christian. Nunu. And he died on the 9th of Tevet, so therefore we fast. Anyways, those are some of the reasons. Let me quickly review, and I do apologize that I have to end, like I say, on time. Shul's in 25 minutes, and I probably have a 23-minute walk at least. Shul, and I don't know where I'm going, but we'll find it. Okay, so just very, very quickly, to review, we discussed the issue of doing business with idolaters just before their holidays, and how can that be? And that says, obviously, this is our whole tradition. We live in non-Jewish environment in the state of Israel, but even here. And Tosfot gives various answers, maybe because it'll create tension, or if you don't know, maybe it's not idolatry. And I like the idea, Ava, and I like the idea that he theoretically throws out the idea that if somebody does avodas, if they worship, not because they believe, because their parents schlepped them to shul, to church, it doesn't really count. That's not a avodazar. That's it's an unbelievable thing, an important lesson for us. We can send lessons to non-idolaters. We have to treat them nicely and give them charity. They're human beings. We can't have anything to do with their worship. We can't drink their wine, et cetera, et cetera. But we have to be nice to them, and et cetera. I always say, err on the side being nice. If you're not sure, err on the side of being nice, I think God will forgive you than to, err on the other way. And then we discussed some of the minhagim as a reaction to Christianity or a reaction to the Karaism. Some of the psukim we say, wine that we may not fasting in Erev Rosh Hashanah, white wine, etc. And then we discussed the 10th of Tevet, which really begins as a 3-day fast, so the Slichos begin. On the 8th of Tevet, the day of translation of the Torah, and the Slichos say 3 days of darkness. So that would be all 3 days for the translation of the Torah. And translations are like everything in life, complex. There's pros and cons, and you have to be aware of them. And maybe not everything, and I do believe this, not everything should be translated. Certainly, not that we're against sharing knowledge. Just learn Hebrew so you can read it in the original. Not God forbid we'll hide that knowledge from you, but maybe. I'm sorry, hold on a second. And just, and then we discussed why the various approaches for this strange fast that the Shulchan Aruch says we fast on the 9th. The whole siman is strange. We don't fast on any of those days. But he quotes all these days we fast, and we don't even know why we don't fast and why we're fasting on the 9th of Tevet. Okay, very, very quickly, I do have to run. So any questions? Just want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. Please, God. Yeah, correct. The Simon Rush was written by the son of the Rebbe of Berlin. That, I thought that's what I said. Well, his name was Berlin. Correct. Okay, please God, next week we'll be back on the regular schedule. I'll have time to answer questions at the end. I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. I really, really want to thank you. I greatly do appreciate your coming earlier, and those who came from Israel, also wonderful, and we look forward to learning with you. I just sent out an email. I think it was scheduled to go out in the middle of this class, so hopefully nobody actually saw it yet, with our winter schedule of all our winter classes coming up for learning online. I wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom, and please God, we look forward to learning with you. Thank you very much. And I'll take, if you want to send me email of any questions, you know, please God, I'll pick up with that next week. Okay. Thank you very much.
Shabbat shalom.
Okay.
Shabbat shalom. Thank you.
Shabbat shalom.
Thank you.